Fellow members, one of our theosophical mothers once told me a story of the conversation which occurred between her children. They were of various ages, the eldest being Mary, who probably was about 7 or 8. And then there were others in about 5 and 4, perhaps. And they were, as children do, you know, thinking even of these very problems of God, and where is he, and how does he make things? And one of the familiar questions evidently was asked by these children. One of the little ones asked Mother, "Well, Mother, who made the world?" "Oh, God made the world, of course, dear," said Mother. "Well then," piped up the little voice, "if God made all the world, then who made God?" Then Mary the elder there chimed in by saying, "Oh, don't tell her, Mother, because she'll only ask who made who. Well, there you are. That's what we've been asking ourselves. Who made who? Trying to push consciousness back past local creative manifestation towards the absolute source of all. Who made who? Well, let us see what Madame Blavatsky has to say to us. And here I am, picking up the threads of my first talk and repeating somewhat, in other words, some of the basic ideas. In the Secret Doctrine, we read, "Father, Mother spin a web, which is the weft and warp of the universe, the very fabric of all material substance and things." And we may assume metaphorically that on that web the divine weaver, that's the Logos of whom I was speaking as the first emanation from the Absolute towards the end of my first talk, metaphorically then, on that web the divine weaver constructs the great design of the universe to be, conceives it, projects it as a great idea, and then makes that idea manifest right down to the physical world, to nature herself. Otherwise stated, before creation, there exists a state throughout space and substance of absolute quiescence, darkness, night. Then, and it must be a very dramatic moment, if one may use this such a word, a change occurs from eternal vibration in the unmanifested to vortical, spinning motion in the phenomenal or manifested world. You find that in several cosmogonies, where the very first manifestation is spoken of as a whirlpool in space, in the vast virgin sea of space, as if the impact of the creative power or word caused a whirling motion. A change also occurs from absolute consciousness to universal and therefore finite consciousness. And this finiteness which emerges is the universal intelligence, which is thought of by the modern scientist, though of course he cannot really prove it, great though the evidence is, for the activity of a directive mind behind all the mysterious processes of nature. It is there, says Theosophy, for this is the one major cosmic deific principle and power in all creation. This, with all reverence, is God. And wise is he who thus conceives of God as an impersonal, cosmic, deific principle, power, life, and law. Now let us move on to the next step in the vast creative process. It is the emanation of what is called in Greek philosophy the logos, or word. And that Greek term, logos, means both intelligence and the sound of a word. And so we are brought to what is known as the logos doctrine. The fashioning of the emanated universe, the production or the direction of the production of all its myriad beings and the forms they inhabit as a result of the sound of the Word of God, the creative voice, the cosmic logos, the Christ indwelling. Sound, you know, even physically, does create forms, and that we can easily prove for ourselves. If you stretch a membrane, like, shall we say, the skin on a drum, or on any other similar, somewhat cylindrical object, and then scatter some sand on it, and then either sing into it or draw a violin bow down it, better, I have found in experiments, to sing into it on different notes, to chant, for example. Each note, of course, sets the skin vibrating. The stretched membrane vibrates in response to the sound of the note. This, in its turn, causes the sand to dance up and down in response to the vibratory movement. And then, this is very mysterious, really, then, when the vibration dies down, it is found that the sand has settled in a definite geometric pattern. Thus we can, if we like, prove to ourselves that sound produces mathematical, geometrical forms. And this can help us to understand why the word logos is given to the first creative power, the logos or word, by whom all things were made. We find this, you know, in many of the cosmogonies of the world, both Egyptian and Hindu and others. For example, in the Egyptian description of this vast creative procedure, the logos is said to be poised above or within the vast waters of space. And when manifestation is to recommence, he utters his creative cry, which is translated as, "Come unto me." In consequence, says Egyptian cosmogony, from within the great deep, all the seeds of living things, which hitherto had been quiescent, sleeping during creative night, gradually sprout, as it were, germinate, and sprout, and thereafter there begins to appear on the surface, so to say, of the waters of space, the first forms of living things. You remember I spoke of the creative logos, Horus crowned with the sun disk, seated above a lotus bloom which is gradually opening, floating upon an infinite ocean. And there he is said to utter the creative word, to express the divine idea as sound, as a result of which all things begin to come into being. So when the vibrations of the voice of God impinge upon virgin space, they tend to draw matter into coordinated forms, expressive of the divine idea of the universe which is to be. In some cases and in some cosmogonies, this is referred to as a song, the song of the Lord, which is perpetually composed and perpetually performed. And many philosophers regard the Logos as a divine yogi whose concentration never wavers for one moment, whoever holds in his highest thought the one divine idea of the universe as a whole. This he expresses in sound, chanting his cosmic mantras, as they are called, and in uttermost perfection. And without even the possibility of a break in the concentrated performance of his creative act, he, as it were, conceives and produces the great symphony and symphony of creation. And that is why he and his assistants are sometimes called Dhyan Chohans, lords of contemplation. Thus the one alone dwells, it is taught, in concentrated thought upon the ideal, the archetypal forms, and chants their sounds from one eternity to another. And by his ever-uttered word, he brings universes into existence, sustains them, and perfects them as they evolve. This is really a wonderful cosmogonical concept, isn't it? That behind all creation there exists the Lord of contemplation, the Logos, who brings all things into existence by his thought and holds them there until the time of dissolution arrives. If, and this cannot happen, of course, but if the Logos failed to maintain his concentration for a trillionth part of a fraction of a second, what would happen? Why, the whole universe would vanish. The archetype would disappear, disintegrate. The creative song or word would cease, and all would instantly sink back into the condition of virginal space. But that cannot happen. For the great yogi, as he might be called, the Maha Yogi perhaps, Maha Shiva in Hindu cosmogony, it is he whose formative thought and song are maintained unbroken from dawn to eve of the creative epoch. Now, let us try and follow this process right down to the physical world, where hard, solid, physical objects appear, expressions in solid matter of what is called the divine idea, the archetype. And I've chosen for this talk the hardest, perhaps, of all substances, the diamond, though, of course, we could take organic forms as well. Perhaps I will do so a little later on. Let us take the diamond, then. Behind all physical diamonds, there is the divine thought, diamondness, the abstract, archetypal idea of that aggregation of carbon atoms which produces the diamond. then the chord of diamondness begins to sound forth in the formless worlds. Eventually, it reaches the form worlds, impinging upon the matter of the mental plane, mind stuff. There, mental matter begins to be drawn into geometrical forms, expressive of the creative sound, in its turn expressive of the diamond idea. This has been conceived, held in thought, and expressed as a chord of music by the divine jeweler and craftsman behind the creative scene. The matter of the realm of feeling and desire then begins to be affected. The form is clothed in astral matter, vibrant, beautiful, the thought form and the desire form of diamond have now come into existence. Then, following the procedure down, eventually the beam of will, thought, sound, or if you like, will, thought, word force, this beam of concentrated power, thought, sound, strikes the etheric world, where, of course, at the early phases, matter is far less responsive than that of the astral and mental planes. The guna, or attribute of inertia, resists the formative tendency. Still the divine thought and song continues. Still the creative sound is uttered. The irresistible word is heard and answered by the matter of the denser world, and gradually, in the etheric world, the beautiful etheric matrix or mold of the diamond comes into existence as a result of the divine thought. All is now ready for the physical construction of the diamond. Gradually within that etheric mold, physical matter, in this case the carbon atoms and other components, is drawn together by a mysterious process of cohesion into an atomic pattern, which is the diamond design. Precipitation occurs at the dense physical level of the divine idea, diamondness, diamond thought, diamond love, if you like, diamond song, which now become a jewel, the physical diamond here on earth. I'm aware that that's an imperfect description, but it will do to help us to understand the procedure. For metaphorically, the word has been made flesh, and that the Logos has thought of and brought into existence without pause diamondness. He's chanted the diamond word. He's drawn the carbon atoms within the design of the diamond form. And this throughout all creation, animate and inanimate, and at all levels, is said to be part of the procedure of the emanation, fashioning, and perfecting of a universe. And I repeat, if for a single moment he, the creative Logos, awoke from his creative dream, if you like, came out of the creative trance, the universe would vanish like a dream. I wonder if that thought reminds you of anything. Anything in childhood literature in which that last idea, that all the universe would vanish if the great dreamer awoke? For it is reflected, you know, in a wonderful fantasy. Do you remember Alice in Wonderland and Alice Through the Looking Glass, and how, whilst Alice is walking in the wood with Tweedledum and Tweedledee, they hear a strange sound in the distance? And Alice asks them what the noise is. Now I quote, "It's only the Red King snoring," said Tweedledee. "Come and look at him," the brothers cried, and they each took one of Alice's hand and led her up to where the king was sleeping. "He's dreaming now," said Tweedledee, "and what do you think he's dreaming about?" Alice said, "Nobody can guess that." "Why, about you," Tweedledee exclaimed, clapping his hands triumphantly. "And if he left off dreaming about you, where do you suppose you'd be?" "Where I am now, of course," said Alice. "Not you," Tweedledee retorted contemptuously. "You'd be nowhere. Why, you're only a sort of thing in his dream." "If that there king was to wake," added Tweedledum, "you'd go out, bang, just like a candle." "I shouldn't," Alice exclaimed indignantly. "Besides, if I'm only a sort of thing in his dream, what are you, I should like to know?"
"Ditto," said Tweedledum.
"Ditto, ditto," cried Tweedledee. He shouted this so loud that Alice couldn't help saying, "Hush, you'll be waking him. I'm afraid you'll wake him up if you make so much noise."
"Well, it's no use your talking about waking him," said Tweedledum, "when you're only one of the things in his dream. You know very well you're not real."
"I am real," said Alice, and began to cry.
"You won't make yourself a bit realer by crying," Tweedledee remarked. "There's nothing to cry about."
"If I wasn't real," Alice said, half laughing through her tears, for it all seemed so ridiculous, "I shouldn't be able to cry if I wasn't real."
"I hope you don't suppose those are real tears," Tweedledum interrupted in a tone of great contempt.
"Don't you think that's remarkable? For there we have a mathematical genius, Lewis Carroll, perhaps not knowing quite what he is doing, depicting with great beauty, with fantasy, and yet with extraordinary reality, the fact that we are indeed all beings in the great dream of the king, who is the logos of our universe." Tweedledum and Tweedledee told Alice that she was only a thing in the Red King's dream, that if he woke up for a moment she would disappear, and that the same was true of them also.
So you see, we are presented there, in a childhood's tale, with the idea that all objective appearances are the product of divine thought. And so this does not only apply to the diamond, which I used as an example, it's not only true of Alice, and of Tweedledum and of Tweedledee, who are personifications of the dual mentality of man, it is in some measure applicable to the whole phenomenal cosmos. All is said to be, as it were, a dream of the Logos, the one great dreamer of all. And so, as is said, not only diamonds, not only Alice, which is ourselves, but all things, the ruby, the sapphire, all living things, birds, animals, trees, plants, men, the nature spirits, and the angelic hosts, all of these, all of us together, for after all we are one, and but the temporary and the relatively ephemeral projections of aspects of the great symphony of creation by which the divine archetype or idea in eternity, the pattern in the mount, is temporarily manifested in the outer worlds. The voice of God expressing the divine idea causes universes, all that they contain, and all that they will ever produce, unto the end of creative day, to appear from pre-cosmic space. Then, when the great day draws to a close as it does, night then comes on, and all sinks back into no thing. Or as it is said in the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, lo, the stars are setting, and the phantom caravan has reached that no thing it set out from. Oh, make haste. Then night again broods over the great deep, and there is silence and darkness where once there had been the Word and the Light. Nevertheless, once more the hour will strike. Again from the Absolute there will emanate the Logos of a universe, a reincarnation, remember, of its predecessors. For this concept of human evolution to perfection through successive lives on earth is but a minor manifestation of the vast cycle of the forthgoing and return of universes themselves. Even Logoi, even the great creative one alone, it is to be assumed, reincarnates in cosmos after cosmos, and presumably, and with all reverence we may perhaps say, he also, with his universes and all that they contain, is undergoing a process of evolutionary unfoldment. I hope that doesn't sound an irreverent idea, but surely it must be so, for all things unfold, obviously, from less to more. And it's because of this, as Ruysbroeck, the Flemish mystic, says, the thought has arisen in the minds of men that God goes to school. Strange idea, isn't it? But if you'll ponder it, you'll see that it must be so. And so at each new manifestation, the Logos carries the creative and evolutionary processes to still greater heights. As stated in the Secret Doctrine, this orderly and harmonious progression is without conceivable beginning or imaginable end.